L.edu.
Good morning, welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, how extensive is the Burmese python infestation in South Florida? According to our first guest today, pretty massive. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Later, there are some proposed cuts to Social Security being considered in Washington. Also, the cost of some prescription drugs, drugs that people rely on. Some of those costs have skyrocketed. More about that in the second part of today's program. First, a reminder that you can subscribe to the podcast of this daily show by simply going to wmnf.org/podcast. Well, in the Big Cypress National Preserve just east of Naples last week, officials captured the largest python ever found in the park. The female Burmese python was more than 17 feet long and weighed 140 pounds. The python had 73 developing eggs. Wildlife managers were using male pythons attached with radio transmitters to track down the breeding females as they worked to remove these invasive snakes. One of the leading Burmese python scientists in the state is Ian Bartoszek, a wildlife biologist at the nonprofit Conservancy in Naples. All right. Well, Ian, can you hear me all right? All right, we've got a little bit of technical problems here. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM.
Ian Bartoszek, wildlife biologist at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida.
All right. Well, Ian Bartoszek, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I was reading about the 17-foot female Burmese python found last week, captured in Big Cypress. That is a big snake.
Yes, it's a large apex predator. They're invasive. As we all know, they're not supposed to be here, and they're taking a toll on our native wildlife.
How many snakes of that size would you estimate to be in Big Cypress or the Everglades or the surrounding area?
That's the million-dollar question. This is such a cryptic ambush predator that no one's been able to give an accurate census or get at the actual density of these snakes out there. So we need to know those numbers because we can't really equate our removal efforts as being successful unless we sort of have a target knowing what we've got out there.
Now, Ian, you're a wildlife biologist with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Just tell us, where do you fit in and where does the Conservancy of Southwest Florida fit in tracking down these big snakes?
Sure. We're a not-for-profit environmental organization in Naples, and I'm the principal investigator on a radio telemetric study tracking pythons since 2013, and we were trying to get a sense of, like the questions you were asking, how many of these snakes are out there, what are they doing, what are their habits, and so we started tracking Burmese pythons, and during the study, a couple years in, we started to find that our male pythons were leading us to breeding female pythons in the winter months, and we sort of ran with that. And what you're seeing from the large snake from the Big Cypress tracking team is the results of hard work on the ground tracking male pythons, and they will invariably lead you to breeding females during the winter months in the breeding season.
So in other words, you're using male pythons to kind of track down the female pythons?
Yep, you got it. You got to work with what you've got, and you got to use this animal's biology against them. They don't put themselves nicely in traps for us. We have to go out and find them, and we call these animals sentinel snakes. Some people refer to them as Judas animals, and having a male with a known home range that you've followed over the years, in that box, if you will, that snake can lead you to those reproductively active females. And the females are the reproductive unit of the population. We don't really care about the males. We want to get them out just the same. But it's kind of one of those things, a snake in the hand is worth many in the bush. And we use these males effectively to locate those females off-grid that you would never be able to find otherwise. There's very few tools in the toolbox to effectively locate Burmese pythons. If you've been keeping up with the stories over time, there's python hunters, bounty hunters, programs. This is the tracking effort using snakes to find snakes, and that has a lot of utility. Those male pythons, if as they go around their home range, they will sniff out those females for you, and then you also have to be a good python hunter to sort of recognize the habitat and then pretty much be ready to rumble when you walk in on a big pile of pythons. And so this one that you're alluding to recently was the largest snake to date that they have found in the Big Cypress National Preserve, not in Florida itself. And you're seeing the utility of using this method to locate big female breeding pythons that you wouldn't be able to find otherwise.
So somehow you got a hold of a male and you attached a radio transmitter to the male. Could you tell us a little bit more about how that was done?
Yep. To get into the python tracking business, you first have to catch some live male pythons. So we search for them during the winter months when the cold fronts are coming out and they tend to come out and bask. And then if it's a good candidate animal, we'll bring them in, and they can't wear a collar just by the nature of the beast, so they need to be surgically implanted with a radio transmitter device, and then they're stitched up and they're sent out fit for duty, and we stay on their tail, and it usually leads with a big ends with a big female at the end of that rainbow.
Now, I understand that this time of year, right up until the end of April, this is the breeding season for the Burmese python, and a female is able to track not just one or two suitors, but a bunch of suitors. Is that correct?
Sure. To refine that, the breeding season is basically over. The males that I have out, I have 25 male pythons that I track, and they're all have lost interest, and they're sort of licking their wounds from traveling across country, looking for mates, and maybe some combat with other males. But April is usually the month we see them lose interest in the breeding season. The females have those developing eggs. This is an egg-laying snake. And she's kind of, in the month of April, all those snakes that we didn't find out there will be cooking their eggs inside, then they'll deposit them, and then they'll stay with those eggs for 2 months out of the year and incubate them. They're almost impossible to find when they choose that clutch site. And so the trick is trying to get after them and find them before they lay the next generation and keep repeating the cycle.
So unlike some reptiles that might build a mound or something, a Burmese python does not build any sort of nest or mound or anything like that.
Well, we've seen them utilize gopher tortoise burrows down here in southwest Florida and armadillo burrows, and if they don't have them to work with in their habitat type, they'll choose a higher patch of ground. They might make a surface clutch and get under dense vegetation, but they're so cryptic you'd likely not see them unless you walked right by them. And to that point, even with a radio transmitter inside one of these pythons, I can tell you, because we've walked in on thousands of observations, they're almost impossible to find. You could have a 100-pound snake coiled up in the grass and you'd never know it was there. But I do want to mention for your listening audience that they are not a threat to us from what I've seen. They're interested in our native wildlife. Like I mentioned, we've walked in on thousands of these observations. They just want to get away or protect themselves when they're on their egg clutch. But we have documented some interesting prey remains that we've seen inside of Burmese pythons. And so it is the wildlife threat of the day for South Florida for sure.
We're talking with Ian Bartoszek. He's with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, and this is WMNF in Tampa. We're talking about the Burmese python infestation in the Everglades and surrounding areas. So, Ian, what did you find as you opened up these pythons? What do they eat, and what mammal populations are at risk, and what bird populations are at risk because of the prevalence of these pythons?
Well, the Burmese python that's native to Southeast Asia is a generalist predator, and you put them in our Everglades ecosystem, and they're interested in our mammals and our birds. And so when they're small and they get started, they're a couple feet in length already out of the egg, and they're already eating into our rodents, moving their way up to mesomammals and into our wading birds. And I believe some of our research collaborators at the University of Florida have documented over 24 species of mammal already found in the bellies of pythons from the greater Everglades, and over 37 species of native bird found in the Everglades and in the stomachs of pythons. So generalist predator eating themselves through the food web here, and who knows what the end result will be. They're here to stay in the Everglades, and the system is responding and balancing itself out accordingly, if you will. But I've heard accounts in Everglades National Park, you would be hard-pressed to find a rabbit. Driving along the roads over the past decades, they would be a common sight, and now you can't find them. And a researcher did a study to try to, he didn't really believe that statement, so he outfitted rabbits with radio transmitters and put them in three different locations throughout the state. And in the area of the park that they knew they had pythons, within 6 months, 77% of those rabbits were tracked to the bellies of pythons. So if rabbits are being impacted and all the other creatures, it just makes you wonder what's really going on out there. And there was a day on this research project for us, April 15, 2015, where we tracked a small female python that had a transmitter. And when we came across her in one of the state parks, she had a massive prey bulge. We brought her out to try to get a radiograph, and she regurgitated a small fawn. And when we measured, we weighed the python, we weighed the fawn, we found that the python was 31.5 pounds, and the fawn was 35 pounds.
Wow.
So here's an apex predator that can eat something over its own body mass. It's amazing.
So our deer population, our raccoon population, our bobcat population, possum population, rabbit population, all disappearing in the Everglades because of the pythons?
It's quite possible. Nobody has that definitive study aside from the rabbit telemetry study I mentioned. So the impact is a bit unknown because nobody's done the baseline comparative study. But I would ask you, and especially with the photo of the large 17-foot python you're seeing, what do you think it took for that python to reach that body mass? It's amazing what these animals are doing, and they're basically turning our native wildlife into large constrictor snake.
You said the python doesn't present a danger to humans. They don't kill humans, or when the hunters finally picked up that 17-foot-long female last week, the female didn't try to attack in any way?
Well, I don't know the specifics of that capture, but when we've removed large female pythons, they can throw their weight around, but in the breeding season, when you capture them that way, they're a bit subdued for whatever reasons going on in their biology and the reproduction. But still, you know, over 100-pound snake, it's an apex predator, but I've always been amazed at how quickly you can capture a large apex predator like that, put it in a bag or a tub, and then get it out of there and then on to the next one. We've wrangled 12,500 pounds in the last 5 years from Southwest Florida in a small area, and we've lived to tell about it. We haven't had any close calls with the pythons, and I always tell people I'm more afraid of driving around on town during season here in Naples than I am tracking pythons.
We're talking with Ian Bartoszek. He's with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. He's a wildlife biologist, and we're talking about the capture last week of a 17-foot Burmese python in the Big Cypress National Preserve, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Do we have any idea what the range of these pythons is? I mean, how far north do they go? How far east? How far west? How far south?
Mm-hmm. to my knowledge, the current range of the wild population of Burmese pythons is already up to Lake Okeechobee, and the range is expanding. That shouldn't make people get worried that they tend to avoid our urban zones. They are creatures of cover, and they're looking for the wildlife. So it's an expanding population, and we have tracked radio telemetered pythons and tracked them since 2013 to try to get a handle on their specific home range, how far these males are moving, how far the females go. And in the western Everglades, if you will, or closer into the Naples zone, we tend to see maybe 3 square miles of territory a large male snake will use, and the females have about half of that range. So the snake that you're seeing the photo of from Big Cypress is a large female found by tracking a male, and that tracking group is beginning to crack the code, if you will, in their immediate area, in the middle of Big Cypress. They're trying to get a sense of, so it's a research and removal program, much like we've done here in Southwest Florida. You really need to know your local neighborhood, and so who knows how far those pythons range. That's why the science is tremendously important. You really need to follow the science on this project, and it'll ultimately lead us to a smarter solution, and that's what this is. It's a link in the chain. The methods used to actually detect pythons are fairly limited, and tracking a python is hard work. It's labor intensive. There's technology involved, logistics, but if you keep up with that snake and it's good at what it does and you're good at what you do, you'll find large female pythons. And if that technique is adopted further across the state, it could be fairly successful when combined with the current hunting contractor type programs.
When you're hunting big game, one of the things you look for is scat. Do these large snakes, do they leave behind scat so you can kind of follow their trail?
Well, the large reptile that it is and how they digest their prey, they don't really leave much behind. It's pretty incredible. Oftentimes we can look for their shed skins, which is an indication that you've got a python that's been pretty comfortable in an area, and you know, you can keep tabs on that. But they're so cryptic that if you don't use, say, a cold weather event that might bring them out to bask because they're ectothermic and they need to raise their body temperature, really the next best solution, if you don't have a road or a levee to hunt along like many of the hunters use in the eastern Everglades, the question is how do you find this snake off the grid? And deploying male sentinel snakes is what we call them to locate the females seems to be an effective tool in specific areas to push back on that reproductive segment of the population. Now, we know we're not going to find them all. There's always a smaller class out there, but maybe until a better smart weapon is developed, it's how you push back on an expanding population.
Are they at home on water as well as land, or do they prefer one to the other?
Good question. Some people refer to them as semi-aquatic, but what I saw during this breeding season is I'd almost redefine that to semi-aquatic, because this snake can really move in the water, and they're very home at the water. You can imagine a snake with such a large body mass slithering across the ground. They're probably much more comfortable in the water, being more buoyant, and just the physics of it. So very comfortable snake in the water. I've adapted very well to our habitats here in South Florida, which is very similar to areas of their native range, which has a bit of a monsoonal climate in Southeast Asia. So as you know, we have our wet and our dry season, and you put this large invasive apex predator, a prolific breeder, and that's the recipe for what we're seeing out there right now.
Now, hunters have been brought in, and I've been reading about hunters from India being brought in. How successful are kind of the good old boys that might be familiar with hunting in the Everglades and then bringing in hunters from Southeast Asia? How successful have they been in hunting down the pythons?
So to that point, I would say, you know, it's a specialized skill set, but there are some good snake hunters out there in the state of Florida, and there's some people very dedicated to the cause, and they'll give a lot of time and effort, and they'll hunt and search lines, and they'll bring in quite a few snakes, and it's one of the tools that we have there. The Arula tribesmen, the Indian snake catchers that were brought in, they have a skill set as well, but it's usually focused for catching venomous snakes in, you know, over in the subcontinent government of India there. So they had a bit of a, they had to become familiar with our habitat over here, if you will. And that's the, that those micro habitat features, how you look for a python. It's definitely an acquired skill. And, there's some good hunters out there and some good trackers, and you put that together and, maybe we can gain some ground on these animals in some specific areas.
Ian Bartoszek is our guest. He's a wildlife biologist with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. We're talking about the Burmese python invasion in the Everglades and surrounding areas, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So how threatened is the ecology, is the ecosystem of South Florida based on the prevalence of these Burmese pythons? Is it disruptive to the natural order of things?
Well, just do some quick math in your mind. If I can tell you that our specific tracking crew has removed 12,500 pounds of python in Southwest Florida from a 55 square mile area since 2014, imagine what it took in our native wildlife to make those 12,500 pounds of python. So the quick answer is yes, they're having an impact, but scientifically you would need some studies to really refine that. But I think it's intuitive. As a research biologist out there, as I described, you know, the day that we saw a small snake already digesting a fawn, of which, you know, is deer the primary prey for our state and federally protected Florida panther, there's cascading effects going on real time throughout the ecosystem, and this Burmese python is here to stay, and we'll see what the ecosystem does as it balances itself out in the future.
So if we're seeing deer or bobcat or foxes or raccoons and rabbits disappear, it's got to have an impact on the food chain and what survives in the Everglades.
Big time, and I think we'll be seeing that those reverberations through the system as we pay attention here. It's definitely one of the prime wildlife issues of our time here in southern Florida. And you know, this is a very impressive creature, the Burmese python, and it's important to mention that they are threatened in their native range. We probably have more Burmese pythons here in South Florida than they do in Southeast Asia. So another question would be, well, why don't we send them there? Different genetics in our Burmese pythons here now, because recall they were escaped or intentionally released from the pet trade, and it's a different beast now than the ones in Southeast Asia. They also carry some different bugs here that they don't have back home, so we can't just ship them back, can't send them to zoos. There's no easy answer, but from someone that's followed these snakes around for the last 5 years, very impressive creature, beautiful animals. Unfortunately, they're not supposed to be here. And, you know, a lot of people have a healthy fear or phobia of snakes. They're two different things. But we have dozens and dozens of native snakes in the state of Florida, most of which are not venomous. We only have a few that usually like to advertise their presence when you're around. And they're, all those native snakes are tremendously important to the ecology. We just happen to have one that gets massive size really quick and is impacting our native wildlife.
And these don't bite, though. They're not venomous.
They're not venomous, but, you know, they have teeth. Anything with teeth will bite. They're constrictor snakes, and so that's how they catch and mobilize their prey, constrict, asphyxiate, unstop the heart, and swallow. And that's their, you know, they're limbless, so that's their way of catching the prey, and it's pretty impressive to see. Are they a threat to us? I don't believe so from what I've seen. If we can live with alligators in the state of Florida, we can live with Burmese pythons in the future. But, yes, it's an apex predator in their, you know, there's no documentation of them eating humans in the wild. This isn't a reticulated python. This is the Burmese python we're talking about. But still, not to sugarcoat it, these are massive animals. That's their evolutionary niche. They get big. They get big quick. And then their apex, top of the food chain.
All right. So you mentioned 20,000 pounds of Burmese pythons, but this one last week was 140 pounds. You have eight of those, and you've got 1,000 pounds already, or
there you,
just about.
Yes.
So
there you go.
You're not that many. It doesn't take that many snakes to add up to 20,000 pounds.
if they're over 100 pounds, but you're looking at the average size python that we've seen is 20 to 30 pounds here in Southwest Florida, a lot of small males. But when you see a snake, you know, over 100 and something pounds, it's generally large female. Who knows how long she's been out there? Nobody has an age on those snakes, maybe 15, maybe 20 years. But we have seen male pythons get up to 140 pounds, which is pretty impressive. So, yes, to do the math, it's what's behind those numbers, how many of them are there in that equation. But to go to your original question, how many of these large snakes are out there, you just don't know. But cracking the code with radio telemetry, chasing them down on the ground, it starts to reveal a pattern out there across the landscape, and that's why following the science on this issue is tremendously important.
Ian, so you don't have any hope that scientists and hunters will eventually win the battle and begin to reduce the population?
Well, win the war, I'm cautiously optimistic. We're definitely winning battles, especially areas close in to town. I hate to say never is a strong word. Eradication seems off the table, but who knows what will be developed with new technologies in the future. It almost sounds science fiction, some of the things I've heard out there. But currently, limited tools in the toolbox to actually detect and effectively remove pythons at this point in time.
What would you say the wildest idea about possibly capturing more of these? What's the wildest idea that you've heard?
The wildest idea that I've heard? Geez, I don't really commit them to memory because I'm kind of on to the next. But I've heard a spectrum of techniques or suggestions. But I tend to just focus on the ones that would have utility, and I can weed them out pretty quick, and because I know the species quite well, and it's easier to just sort of cut them off and just sort of stick with what might have utility, because when you're dealing with a snake that's across these habitat types across the greater Everglades, much like the one that you saw the photo of with the big cypress crew, how do you locate a cryptic ambush predator in the middle of nowhere out in a giant national preserve that has very few roads or levees to work with? You use a snake to find a snake and gather the science to help researchers continue to crack the code to possibly use this animal's biology against them. And one of the forward-looking techniques or technology could be pheromones, because this is a very chemical, these snakes live in a chemical world, and imagine what we may be able to do if we sort of cracked that code, if you will, had a pheromone, the chemical signatures these animals use to attract each other in the breeding season. We might be able to disrupt that on a larger scale.
Python perfume.
There you go.
So, and I imagine they're well camouflaged. They fit right in with the browns and greens and golds of the Everglades.
They're remarkably camouflaged, as I mentioned earlier, even with a radio transmitter, and we'd hard to find them sometimes, but we've kind of got dialed in. They don't break cover often. They do want to stay hidden, and they have a, much like an alligator, they kind of know when you're on to them, and they're already sort of planning their escape. That's what it is. They're trying to get away. They're not trying to come and attack you. But, you know, a female python on her nest will defend her clutch, and I don't blame her, and that's when we've usually seen highly defensive snakes. So they're not interested in us. They're just very interested in our native wildlife.
And when they go on the defensive, what do?
Well, they coil and they'll defend themselves. You know, it's much like if something tried to grab us, we'd probably try to defend ourselves. They'll do the same. And so, you know, they'll strike out and they'll try to get away. And if you get a hold of them, sometimes they can musk as well, which is an odor that they'll put out to try to deter predators. So the acquired skill when you're catching pythons is to get them right behind the neck so they can't bite, and then grab the tail, hold it away from you so you don't get covered in musk, and then repeat.
Ian, I have one last question. That is,
sure.
is it still legal for reptile pet owners to import or to possess a Burmese python? And do you blame the pet owners, or do you blame, what do you blame for this infestation?
Well, your first question on the Burmese python, the state of Florida has listed it as a conditional species. So you do need permits, but reputable breeders can still breed them. But if you have it as a pet, you need a permit and to show that animal or keep it. And it's also on the list that was a bit proactive with some other large lizards and some other large snakes like reticulated pythons and the anacondas. So, you know, the Burmese python's very much out of the bag, hopefully lesson learned. But what do we blame? Well, Florida has many ports of entry. There's a vibrant pet trade. There's very good herpetoculturists, reptile keepers, and then there's probably some that shouldn't be keeping large snakes in tanks that eventually they get too big for those tanks or the snake escapes. There seems to be an ongoing myth that Hurricane Andrew is the cause of the Burmese python population, being that it knocked down some breeding facilities. That's just one link in a long chain. Hurricane Andrew came through in the early 90s. Burmese pythons were established in the Everglades National Park in the 80s, that we believe. So perfect storm of situations. You got to be a responsible pet owner. And to that point, you know, to some of your listening audience, if you do have a non-native invasive animal that you can't care for, the state of Florida has an amnesty program. Just search for that online and see where the next one is. And they'll take a pet that shouldn't be released in the wild back, no questions asked, and they'll try to adopt it out. Also, if you see non-native animals in the state that need to be reported, there's a smartphone app. It's the I've Got One app. You can find that on the App Store. And then the state Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has a hotline that if you know you see something large and charged, not supposed to be there in front of you, you can call 1-888-I've-Got-One. But I would caution you, get familiar with your native wildlife. There's a lot of small snakes out there with patterns on it that people can confuse for a baby Burmese python. You're very unlikely to see a small Burmese python, especially up at this point in time where your listening audience might be chiming in or listening in from. You're more than likely to see a native snake 9 out of 10 times. So don't kill on first sight. Get a photo. You can report that, and they can dispatch a responder. And that's another measure that the state is involved with to help remove and respond to sightings.
But you are asking the public, if they do see a Burmese python, to turn that python in, or at least say where you saw it.
Yes, you can take a photo and you can report that, and those were the avenues to do so. Don't take matters in your own hands unless, you know, you have a little bit of training dealing with the Burmese python. And yes, so it's a pretty remarkable creature. It's here to stay. It's impacting our native wildlife. A little information goes a long way. We tend to fear what we don't understand, and hopefully this won't cause more fear to your listening audience. It would give more awareness, and now everyone is deputized in this invasive animal awareness network. And so get your smartphones out. You see something that's not supposed to be here, log it in on that I've Got One app, or, you know, call the hotline, the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
Ian Bartosek, thanks a lot. Is there anything else that you'd like to point out or say about the finding of this 17-foot, 140-pound female Burmese python?
I'd say expect to see more snakes of that size, especially as this technique is infused throughout various agencies and different organizations. It's currently one of the best ways to lead researchers back to large pythons, and so to be continued.
Ian Bartosek, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Thank you for having me.
That was Ian Bartosek, who is a wildlife biologist at the Nonprofit Conservancy in Naples. He's one of the leaders in trying to track down these snakes that have taken over much of the Everglades and displaced the mammal population. Just last week, a female python weighing 140 pounds, 17 foot long, was captured in the Big Cypress National Preserve. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. The Trump administration is moving forward with an effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Under President Trump, the Justice Department has signed on to the effort by the state of Texas to have the Affordable Care Act declared unconstitutional. Our next guest says that if the ACA or Obamacare is repealed, it could have negative effects on Medicare. Our guest also has some thoughts about the high cost of prescription drugs. And President Trump's 2020 budget proposal breaks one of the president's biggest campaign promises to voters, that he would leave Medicaid, Social Security, and Medicare untouched. Over the next 10 years, Trump's 2020 budget proposal aims to spend $1.5 trillion less on Medicaid, instead allocating $1.2 trillion in a block grant program to states, and $25 billion less on Social Security, and $845 billion less on Medicare. Here to talk about all these issues is Max Richmond, the president of the nonprofit group, the National Committee to Protect Social Security and Medicare. And Max, welcome back to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
I want to ask you about, first of all, the Justice Department and the Trump administration. They've signed on to the effort in Texas to have the Affordable Care Act declared unconstitutional by the federal courts. Tell me what you think about that.
Well, if you are on Medicare and a beneficiary, or will be, this ruling, if it's upheld, would be devastating. The Affordable Care Act, contrary to a lot of the propaganda we heard for years after it was passed, added benefits to the Medicare program, extended the life of the Medicare program, and those benefits and the solvency extension would disappear under this court, if this court case is upheld. So, I remember after the Affordable Care Act was passed, a lot of campaigns were focused on how the Affordable Care Act stole, and that's the word, $800 billion from the Medicare program. The truth that people are finally realizing is, yes, the Affordable Care Act saved about that amount of money out of the Medicare program. That came from reimbursement rates to providers. Most of that saving was plowed back into things that seniors really have come to count on, an annual wellness visit at no out-of-pocket cost, a wide array of preventative treatments, colonoscopies, mammograms, diabetes screening, for the first time with no out-of-pocket cost, the out-of-pocket cost for prescription drugs under the Part D Medicare program was closed. The extension of the solvency, the financial condition of the program, was 16 years. All of that disappears. And I have to say, I watched the Republican primary debates pretty religiously. And President Trump, then candidate Trump, was the only one who said time and again, I won't cut Social Security, I won't cut Medicare, I won't cut Medicaid. And I know we're going to talk about this a little more later on in the segment. But the Affordable Care Act repeal, whether it's through congressional action, which failed, or through the court cases, would in fact be cutting the Medicare program.
Hmm. What happens to the people who were subject to the donut hole but no longer are subject to the donut hole?
They would become subject to the donut hole again. They would, the infamous donut hole, where you paid out of pocket for a certain time until you reached a catastrophic level, which under the Affordable Care Act is almost closed, would reopen. So there's no way you can paint this court case as anything other than seriously damaging the Medicare program and Medicare beneficiaries, current and future.
We're talking with Max Richman, who is the president of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Just want to ask you, the president is promising to replace the Affordable Care Act with something that's even better, with lower deductibles, better premiums, lower cost premiums, and everybody would be covered. But one of the people that he's looking at to lead the effort to find this new program, which has not been announced yet, is our junior U.S. Senator Rick Scott. Do you have any thoughts about Rick Scott being the one to lead us to a better health care program?
Well, from what I have gathered since the president made the statement in the Capitol that the Republican Party would be the party of health care, he has not been able to secure the support of some of the members of the Senate that he named that would lead that effort. You know, there is no replacement plan. Where's the plan? Remember when Gary Hart, Senator Gary Hart, ran against Vice President Mondale, a famous line in that debate where Vice President Mondale said, where's the beef?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the beef?
Yeah.
And when it comes to a replace, there is nothing. So, you know, we have not a perfect, but a darn good benefit added, several benefits added to the Medicare program, important benefits to the Affordable Care Act. There's no replacement.
I want to ask you about the high cost of prescription drugs, and I just want to single out one drug for a moment because it's getting a lot of publicity. Insulin, which was developed by medical scientists 90 or 95 years ago, the cost of insulin has been skyrocketing, especially in the last 18 years. Do you have any idea about why the cost of insulin is skyrocketing?
You know, just as with many, many other drugs, the reason the cost of insulin and other drugs has gone up so much, so dramatically, is because the pharmaceutical companies are in the driver's seat. They can charge whatever they want, and they do. And, you know, we have seen, again, in the last election, so many campaigns focused on the high cost of prescription drugs. I think, actually, we're at a watershed moment where Republicans and Democrats have heard so much from their town hall meetings, from their constituent interactions, about the need to hold down the cost of prescription drugs. And the way this can be done, the best way, there are some bipartisan approaches that I think can help, but the best way, which would be to take away that ability from the drug companies to charge whatever they choose. And we have leverage, but we don't use it. Under the Medicare program, when prescription drugs were added in 2003, the government is specifically prohibited from negotiating with the drug companies. Why? This doesn't make any sense. I can tell you one thing. I was in the Capitol back then when the bill passed about 6 in the morning. I stayed there till about 2. I went with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare wasn't in the room when the deal was made to protect the pharmaceutical companies, to insulate them from any negotiations by the federal government. This has been something that has been long overdue. It's been talked about since 2003, and we need to change that restriction on the federal government. That by itself, that kind of leverage through the Medicare program. You know, Medicare has over 40 million beneficiaries, and to tell the Medicare program you are not allowed to negotiate on behalf of all of these beneficiaries to get the best price, just let the drug companies charge what they want, let them make as much money as they want, let them pay their executives as much money as they want, that's why we're where we're at.
Max, it's interesting that you say that, because I believe in Canada, the provinces are allowed to negotiate with the drug pharmaceutical companies to negotiate lower prices. Our governor now wants us here in Florida to be able to buy large shipments of drugs from Canada. He's not calling for Medicare to be able to negotiate lower drug prices, but he is saying, let's go to Canada and buy large amounts of drugs so that the drugs that people need here in Florida to live, they can buy at a reasonable price. What do you make of going to Canada?
I applaud him for that. I think it's about time. We need to do that all over the country, not just in Florida, but on a federal level. You know, in Canada, the same drugs go through the same rigorous inspection and process to be approved for the consumers, and the drugs are that much cheaper because the Canadian government has used the leverage that we are denied in this country. So, you know, the drug companies, they're still making a huge amount of money selling drugs to Canadians. They're just not making the obscene profits that they're making in this country. That the ability to wholesale level to reimport the same drugs from Canada at a cheaper price would be very effective. Another, a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that the reason so many generic and equivalents of brand name drugs are being kept off the market is because the brand name prescription drug companies, they're very creative. They have figured out a way to delay, I call it pay to delay, the generics from being brought to market. That has to change. And in fact, there is bipartisan support in the Senate. Senator Charles Grassley, pretty powerful, the chair of the Finance Committee, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, have joined forces to end this tactic that prevents generics from coming to market in a timely way, which would save not only the government but consumers a huge amount of money. As I said, we're getting to the point when so many members of Congress of both parties are hearing this the high cost of prescription drugs as a top priority. They care about being reelected, and many of them care about doing the right thing for their constituents. So I think this Congress, I think we'll see some real positive results in bringing the cost down. It is not supportable politically to keep hands off of the prescription drug companies and allow them the kind of free reign they've had for so many decades.
We're talking with Max Richmond, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. That's a membership organization that promotes the financial security, health, and well-being of current and future generations of retirees. And this is WMNF in Tampa. So, Max, At the top of our interview, I mentioned that in President Trump's proposed 2020 budget, he wants to cut Medicaid, Social Security, and Medicare, even though, as you mentioned before, during the campaign, he promised not to touch any of those. How serious is the threat? Is Congress likely to follow through and back the president up on his proposal to cut Medicaid, Social Security, and Medicare?
I do think the Congress is going to put the brakes on some of these cuts as the budget process, the appropriations process moves through the House and the Senate. I think that members of Congress, they do have their pulse on the views of their constituents. But, I think it's very telling that a president who campaigned so strongly on not cutting these programs and made those promises. I heard them. You heard them. The American people heard those promises time and again. Now we know those promises were empty promises.
I want to go to something else that happened recently in Washington, and I know you know about this. Congressman John Larson, who's from Connecticut, he was on Capitol Hill, and he reintroduced the Social Security 2100 Act. This bill would boost benefits for America's 62 million Social Security beneficiaries, and according to Congressman Larson, would keep the system on a sound financial footing for the next 75 years. Tell us, do you like what Congressman Larson is proposing?
Yesterday, Congressman Larson, as the chairman of the Ways and Means Social Security Subcommittee, held a hearing, the second hearing that he's held specifically on his proposal. I was honored to be asked to testify. Our organization, the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, wholeheartedly supports the approach in his legislation. It's H.R. 860. It's called the Social Security 2100 Act because it changes the way the Social Security program is financed to make sure that it is solvent for the rest of this century. That's why it's called the Social Security 2100 Act. Not only does it, as you just mentioned, improve benefits, raise the minimum benefit by a few percent, which is important when you're living, as so many are, on mostly or entirely on Social Security. It has a more accurate way of determining what the cost of living adjustment is annually. You know, and there were 3 years in the last 10 that the COLA was zero. There's no way in the world anybody, particularly a Social Security beneficiary, would be able to, with a straight face, agree that there was no inflation for 3 years. That's not plausible if you look at the kinds of things seniors need and rely on. His legislation would change the way that COLA is computed. It would be a larger COLA. Now, how does he do this? Right now, there is a limit on the amount of tax that is imposed on wages. When you earn $132,000, it changes a little every year, but when you earn $132,900, every dollar after that, no more FICA tax. Why? That doesn't make any sense. The legislation that Chairman Larson has proposed that we endorse would begin the payroll tax again, keep it at the cap. I would prefer it be eliminated altogether, that cap, but it would keep the cap at what it is, and it would commence Social Security payroll tax again at $400,000 in wages and above. That would bring in enough revenue with a along with a increase of 2% of the payroll tax stretched out over 24 years. It would mean that someone who makes about $50,000 a year would pay about 50 cents a pay period more into payroll tax. And then those who are wealthy, who are earning over $400,000, would continue to pay payroll tax. This brings in enough revenue to accomplish the things that I just mentioned and protect the program in its for its solvency for the rest of the century. This is particularly important for young people. You know, I've heard, and I testified to this yesterday in the Rayburn House office building. For years, younger people who do come to our town hall meetings and are skeptical that they will ever get a Social Security check, they feel they're more likely to be a UFO or see Bigfoot than ever get a Social Security check. This legislation, if it were enacted, would put that to rest, because it would be undeniable that the program is solvent for the rest of this century, and that is an added benefit to this proposal, to bring young people on board and to have them understand the value of Social Security and the importance of it and the reliability of it.
We're talking with Max Richmond, who is the CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. So Max, I was reading a study yesterday just about baby boomers, and the study said that about half of them have no savings at all for retirement. So if you increase Social Security checks for baby boomers, they're certainly going to be happy, at least that half that has no savings for retirement. But how much could you actually increase a Social Security check under this plan?
Well, the minimum benefit could be increased about $70 or $80 a month. That may not sound like a lot to some people, but if you're just getting by on Social Security, it is enormous. A more accurate and larger COLA is very important, because it's cumulative. You know, if you get 0% COLA for 3 years, that's going to impact your check forever. If you get a larger COLA, it's like money that you have in a savings account. It's compounded, so it will grow exponentially in the future. But those baby boomers, I understand why they're skeptical. They've been bombarded by a lot of misinformation for years that the program it won't be there in the future. There's no money there. The money was stolen. All of that is false. And was, I think, a lot of those myths have been perpetuated by certain interests that would love to get their hands on that Social Security, the financial institutions, rather than have it go through the Social Security program, so they can make money on that investment. And the other thing that I tell younger people, and I hope I thank you for the chance to try to reach them right now on your program. If you are, for example, a 27-year-old worker with a spouse and two children, you have right now about $500,000 in value in life and disability insurance, because Social Security is there. Now, a lot of younger people don't know it, don't realize it till something bad happens in the family, and someone will say, hey, you know, you ought to call Social Security. You're eligible for disability benefits, for survivor benefits, for spousal benefits. A third of Social Security benefits go to non-retired workers. Millions of children get by in life because of Social Security. It used to be, years ago, Social Security would send local staff into high schools to talk about Social Security. They don't do that anymore.
Well, that's how Paul Ryan was able to get through his teen years. His dad died, and he was on Social Security.
And I don't know how he's forgotten all that. On the other hand, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Congressman Richie Neal of Massachusetts, had a similar story, lost his parents when he was young. His family, his siblings, survived because of Social Security survivor benefits and children's benefits. On the contrary to the way former Speaker Paul Ryan has incorporated that experience, Chairman Neal is such a strong believer. I've heard him talk about this. I've heard him tell his history about and connection to Social Security, and he talks from the heart, and I think if people hear that, they can appreciate the value of the program much more than they do now, and certainly more than what they learn from Speaker Ryan's approach.
All right. Well, Max Richmond, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on WMNF, and we'll continue to pay attention to what's happening with Social Security and Medicare.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Max.
Appreciate it.
All right. Great to talk to you. You can find the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare at ncpssm.org. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Please stay tuned for the Midpoint Program with Shelley Reback. And April is Autism Awareness Month. Shelley's guest today will be offering information for families with children on the autism spectrum. That's coming up in the next hour. If you want to comment about today's show, call us up, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. I'm Rob Lurie. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF Tampa. Jimmy Lyles has been our phone.